why was the YouTube video on Diary of the CEO removed?
I don't know.
Everyone wants to eat a healthier diet, but which diet is healthiest?
Cooking skeletal muscle produces carcinogens, and that's why every epidemiologist agrees.
Do you think there's pressures to silence disinformation?
It's all money. There are people working in the dairy industry who are deciding how can they manipulate to sell more cheese and to make you buy it.
We're now joined by Dr. Neil Barnard,
clinical researcher, author, and perhaps the most respected authority on vegan diets.
Get away from the animal products completely, but keep the vegetable oils really low too.
Dr. Barnard claimed that men who eat the most cheese have the lowest sperm count.
I couldn't agree more.
It's got a lot of cholesterol, it's got a lot of sodium. If it were any worse, it would be Vaseline.
Is fat addictive?
This is not your fault at all.
If you reduce your meat intake, you actually do cut your risk of cancer, cut your risk of a heart attack, cut your risk of stroke and diabetes.
But certain foods actually cause weight loss. Don't count calories, don't limit portion sizes. Focus on the power foods and let the foods do the work.
So welcome to Plant-Based News. My name is Joe and I have a fantastic guest with me today, Dr. Neil Barnard. And to me, he is a plant-based hero. He started the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine back in 1985. That's like 40 years ago. And in that time, he's grown the organization to 1 million members and 17,000 physicians. He's helped countless people heal themselves on a plant-based diet. He's written 19 books on this subject. He is also a professor at George Washington University. And he started the Barnard Medical Center, which helps people recover from diabetes and obesity. And amongst all of that, he also has time to lead a band. So without any further ado, welcome Dr. Neil Barnard.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, I feel very, very privileged to have this opportunity to talk to you. I've been following your work for nearly 20 years now, so this is a special moment for me. So the very first question I want to ask you, which is quite basic, is what is a plant-based diet and why do you advocate for it so strongly?
Well, a plant-based diet means doing the opposite of everything that I did as a young person growing up. I grew up in the Midwest in North Dakota of the United States. And, a meal wasn't a meal if it wasn't centered around a pork chop or some roast beef or something like that. Maybe fish for special occasions, but the vegetables were just side dishes that were sort of afterthoughts and didn't really matter. And when people developed heart disease or weight problems or diabetes, we attributed them to old age or genetics, and we didn't really put two and two together. But research really showed that when we change our diet and we focus on the foods that are truly healthful, which happen to be plant foods, vegetables and fruits and whole grains and legumes and all the magical, wonderful things that they turn into. Mm-hmm. And we have power over health issues. So a plant-based diet means you're not eating those things. You're not eating meat, dairy products, eggs. You're not eating things that come from animals. You're focusing on foods from plants.
And why do you advocate for it so much as a doctor? Why is it medically so relevant?
The research has really become very, very clear that when we consume animal products, the cholesterol and the saturated fat that they contain really do us harm. And also, it becomes a deficient diet. When a person is consuming animal products, there's no fiber in those animal products, and you have to have fiber for a healthy digestive tract. That, in turn, affects health in so many other ways. Well, it's not in animal products. There's no vitamin C in animal products, and vitamin C is one antioxidant. There are many, many others. So when we grow up with a sort of seductive burger diet, well, we can develop a taste for these foods, but our nutrition is deficient. And when we focus our foods on plants, our nutrition is dramatically better. What does it translate into? Preventing heart disease, reversing it even. Weight loss, that it can be really very, very easy. Probably even reducing the risk of Alzheimer's disease, and along the way, being able to deal with so many other health issues.
What do you think, what was it about you that made this connection so early on? I mean, there's many, many doctors about nowadays who are advocating a nutrition approach to health. But back in the 80s, that wasn't the case. So what was it that made you say, okay, there's a connection here that I need to pursue?
Peculiarly enough, the first connection for me was, I don't know if you would call it a health connection or an ethical connection or whatever. I was working at a hospital in Minneapolis, and my job was to assist at autopsies when people died in the hospital. I managed the hospital morgue. A person would die in the hospital, and I would pull the body out of the cooler and put the body on a table where the pathologist would do an autopsy to try to understand the cause of death. And one day we had a man who died in the hospital of a massive heart attack. And so I put the body on the examination slab, and he knew that I was going to medical school the following year. So he made sure that I saw everything and that I would learn from this. So he took a scalpel and he went, cut through the skin, pulled the skin back. And then you take what's like a garden clipper and you crunch through each rib, and he pulled the ribs off the chest and he put the ribs on the table, and that exposed the heart, which was filled with atherosclerotic plaque. I'd never seen this before. Mm-hmm. And he sliced open an artery, a coronary artery. And he explained to me, we call them coronary because they crown the heart. And I had gloves on. He said, feel this. And I felt it, and it was like a clay pipe stem. It wasn't a nice, smooth artery. It was like concrete. And he said, bacon and eggs, Neil. And I thought, okay. And we found the same process in the carotid arteries going up to the brain, and in the renal arteries going to the kidneys and so forth. At the end of the exam, he wrote up all his findings: systemic atherosclerosis. Patient died of an acute myocardial infarction. Fine. He leaves the room. I'm left there with this body. I cleaned up, I put all the organs back in, and I took the ribs, and I put the ribs back in the chest and sewed up the skin. And then when I was finished, it was sort of mid-afternoon, it was a long exam. So I went up to the cafeteria and said, do you have anything left to eat? Because I've had a long day. And they said, yeah, here's a plate of ribs. And I looked at it, and it looked just like the body I'd been working on, and it smelled like it. And I didn't become a vegetarian at the time, but I couldn't eat that. And I started to connect the things that we eat with health conditions that we have. And after that, I started to understand more and more about nutrition, and also about all the other issues, about animal issues. When I was a kid, I didn't think about these things at all. I hunted as a child. I drove cattle to slaughter with my uncle. We ate meat all the time. My first job as teenager was at McDonald's, and I started to realize that maybe I was being a little bit narrow-minded. And as time went on, I started to learn more and more about the power of foods to affect all these things.
When you first started having these ideas formulate about this relationship, and you started to vocalize it, was there any pushback, or was it something that was quite acceptable? Or how did you take that from being this internalized, like, awakening, let's call it, into your body of work?
What I started to discover is that, first of all, the effect of nutrition was important. And this didn't start with me. Back in 1948, at the Framingham Heart Study in Framingham, Massachusetts, researchers started to discover that heart disease was predictable based on what your cholesterol was, your blood pressure, your weight, your smoking status. And all of these things are under our control to a degree. So I started to realize that we can bring our cholesterol down, and not just with drugs, but with diet choices. But then I realized I was in medical school, and the lectures didn't really cover this particularly effectively. And when I got into practice, even less so. Doctors were seeing patients, prescribing drugs, sending the patients out. And I've got to tell you, Joe, we didn't do anything about a heart attack until it came in the emergency room door. We had plenty of notice. We knew it was coming. We knew the risk factors. We did not really intervene. We didn't do anything about breast cancer until it showed up on a mammogram. We could tell that there are risk factors for that too. We can help patients to change the things. And then once people are diagnosed, we weren't doing anything about really the causes of it that also caused things to progress. And I felt that we had to change these things, and we had to do research in the right way. So I set up this group with a terrible name called the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, because I wanted to have maybe 12 or 15 doctors who would weigh in on the issues of the day and advise other groups about the steps they could take. And at that time, it was going to be a committee, but it's grown considerably since that time, as you mentioned.
Yeah, you took it from like 12 doctors to 17,000 physicians. That's amazing. So, one of the things I also feel you pioneered is doctors becoming authors, popular authors, and focusing on diet, because the doctor credentials lead so much gravitas to the book. So what was it that led you to do your first book, which that I read? That's my connection, which is Breaking the Food Seduction, because that was pivotal to me. I would actually say that saved my life, because that was the first book I read that didn't blame the patient. It normally, the other books were like, you're a food addict, you've got these issues. And this one said, it's the food, and it's related to dopamine and the reward system. So that was a pivotal moment for me. What brought that book into existence?
You know, well, first of all, Joe, thank you for saying that. You know, it really is true that people do tend to blame themselves. And if they're having issues with food, or issues with their weight or whatever it may be, they'll think, gee, you know, the people in the TV commercials or the people in the magazines, they're having a really easy time of it. Why am I having trouble? And what we have to realize is that marketing and business weighs in heavily in all of this stuff, that foods are designed, and that's not too strong of a word, to be addictive. There are people working in laboratories to try to figure out exactly the mixture of sugar and cocoa butter that will make their chocolate bar be irresistible. And there are people working in the dairy industry who are deciding how can they manipulate the menus of fast food chains to sell more cheese and to make you buy it. And if we think, well, this is my fault, this is not your fault at all. There's a huge machinery pushing you in this direction. And beyond that, they are manipulating your own neurochemicals with foods. They know it. They're aware of it. Their scientists do it. They do it intentionally because it's part of their business model. And so the reason I wrote that book is people don't know about this. And once they know about it and can take some steps to protect themselves, they've got power they didn't have before.
Absolutely. It wasn't easy, but it gave me something to act against. I stopped blaming myself and I took responsibility, which is very different. And that's what that book does. And I highly recommend it. One thing that really stuck out in my journey and other people's that I've heard is the last one to go, because it took me, I did it in succession over 5 or 6 years of quit all of these foods. The last one and the hardest was cheese. Can you talk about cheese being crack and how it's made?
You are not alone. You know, we've been doing research studies here since the 1990s. And people come in and they may have diabetes and weight issues and so forth. And so we'll use a vegan diet, which we explain. A vegan diet is not someone from the planet Vegas. Vegan diet just means no animal products. And so there's no animal fat. And we keep vegetable oils really, really low too, because that combination is so helpful. Patients do great. Their cholesterols come down, they lose weight, and their diabetes gets better. Sometimes it even goes away. However, a fair number of people say exactly what you said, is that there's something about cheese, and it's the one food that people have trouble giving up. And it's also that maybe the food that calls their name for a longer period of time. When people have been vegan for even a month, they really don't miss chicken wings and meat. It just kind of falls to the wayside for whatever reason. But cheese kind of lingers on. And there's a reason. The dairy protein called casein, when it comes out of the cow in milk, goes into the calf's stomach. It breaks apart and releases smaller compounds, peptides, called casomorphins. And that means casein-derived morphine-like compounds. Morphine-like, meaning they are narcotic-like compounds, opiate compounds, that go to the brain and attach to the same brain receptors that any other opiate would attach to. And they're natural because they come from the cow, but in the calf's body, they have a calming effect. And in our body, something else happens. You're not just drinking a little bit of milk. At the factory, As milk converts to cheese, the water is removed, the lactose sugar is removed. You're concentrating that protein. So it's the most concentrated form of casomorphin that you could get. And that's why we think of it as sort of dairy crack, because it's concentrated opiates. And it's you know, people might like ice cream or milk, but they get hooked on cheese.
They definitely do. And I was for a while. To help anyone who might be watching who's still hooked on cheese, can you just share a little bit about how it's made?
Sure. And by the way, in case people think this is maybe a trivial issue, the average person consumes nowadays about 70,000 calories worth of cheese every single year. Wow. So where it comes from, early in the morning, the milk truck arrives at the cheese factory, and the milk is poured into a big thing that looks like a sort of a small swimming pool, and it's stirred up, and you want it to ferment. That's what turns milk into cheese. And so you use bacterial cultures to do that. And they don't use just any bacterial culture. You don't just throw in whatever you could get at the store. The one they use is very particular. Between your toes is our bacteria called Brevi bacteria, B-R-E-V-I bacteria. If you ever had a roommate who didn't do their laundry for an extra special long time, their funky, smelly sock smell, that's Brevi bacteria. And it does smell a bit like cheese, and that's because that's the bacteria that they are using to make cheese. If it smells like old socks, it's Brevi bacteria. They dump it in. They stir it up. And what that's doing is it's causing the milk to start to ferment. Then you need to add rennet. And rennet is an enzyme that causes it to solidify. And rennet historically comes from the fourth stomach of a freshly slaughtered calf. And so a lot of people will not eat cheese for that reason. I mean, it's a cruel thing. But nowadays, a lot of factories use genetically engineered rennet. And of course, they don't write that on the label, because if you said genetically engineered cheese product, nobody would buy it. But you're getting one or the other. Either it's from a calf or it's from genetic engineering. And then they add a ton of salt, a lot, ounce per ounce or gram per gram, more than is in potato chips. A lot more. And then they cut it into blocks. And between the fact that it's sort of a greasy, salty combination, which, let's face it, that's addicting too, like chips and onion rings, the saltiness gets us. Then the casomorphins come in, go to your brain, and a person thinks, okay, life is now complete, just like a person taking any other psychoactive compound.
Wow, it sounds as disgusting as it is. However, what came to mind is your rendition of how it's made and what it is, yet people will turn the blind eye to that, I believe, due to neurology. And I know that you're also an expert in neurology. What's going on there? How can people associate the smell of sweaty feet to something they want to eat?
Well, this happens with more or less anything. Let's say alcohol. When you're 15 years old and you found a beer behind the garage and you decided to take a drink of alcohol for the first time, you know, it doesn't taste good. Liquor, wine, all these things have a real bitterness to it. However, that lasts for a little while, but as the alcohol goes to your brain, it in turn releases dopamine as well. All substances of abuse do. And as the dopamine is released, your brain sort of searches for the stimuli that preceded it and gives them a positive valence. By that, I mean, your brain says, okay, I feel good now. What caused that? Oh, it was that beer. Okay, well, maybe it doesn't taste so funky. Maybe I like it. Cheese does stink. And some people love them. The more they stink, the more they love them. But as it goes down your palate and as the dopamine receptors start to activate, your brain says, what was I just experiencing that led to this? And we start to associate even negative things on their face with this positive outcome. So that's why people end up loving it. But you know, when you talk about blindness, the industry has to keep you blind. It has to tell, they're not going to tell you how many calories are in it or how much salt is in it or what this is going to do to your waistline or your blood pressure, your heart risk. And they are not going to tell you what the animals go through. it's funny, you look at cheese and they have the smiling cow or the laughing cow as if they're having fun. That cow was artificially inseminated every year of her life to produce an offspring. Her offspring were taken away. If they were males, they're killed for veal. If they're females, they're raised in isolation. And her 20-year normal lifespan is cut to about 4 because she's not productive enough after 4 or 5 years, and she's killed for meat. And that's the dairy industry. But we want to pretend that this is some wonderful European tradition that we're carrying on. It's sort of a bad idea that got legs.
Absolutely. So breaking the food seduction, amazing, life-changing for me. And we're going to talk about your new book, The Power Foods Diet, in a moment. But first, I just want to have a little stepping stone with reversing diabetes, because that was the next big aha moment. Once I'd beat the food addiction, I'm now looking at diabetes. And that book, that information, and everything that went alongside it, would just change the way people look at diabetes. And I went vegan on that basis. That book came about for a grant, right? Or did you do some research, some deep research, pioneering research on the plant-based diet and alleviating diabetes?
Yeah, and actually, the roots of that were back in the 1990s. We were known for really promoting human-based research and for encouraging people who were using dogs and cats and other animals to focus on human research instead. And I was contacted by a foundation that was troubled because they wanted to fund diabetes research, but they kept getting grant applications from people for rat experiments. They said, we don't want to study rats. We want to see what we can do to help people. And I said, well, I think you're on the right track. I would study human beings, but focus on diet, because that has to be the issue in diabetes, because diabetes rates are changing around the world and it follows diet changes, especially westernized diets. So they liked this idea. But then unexpectedly, they said to me, would I help them design a study for this? And I said, okay. So I thought that looking at epidemiologically, the countries that have more plant-based diets tend to do better. I thought, what if we use an entirely plant-based diet? And we use this in people who have diabetes already. Let's see what happens. So I was working with Georgetown University here in Washington. And in a pilot study, it was terrific. It worked really, really well. It lowered blood sugars, helped people to reduce their medicines and so forth. So NIH, our National Institutes of Health here, then gave us a grant to do a much bigger trial in a large group of people. And we found that not only was a low-fat vegan diet 3 times better at improving blood sugar compared to the best current diet, something else happened. And that's that I saw for the first time in my whole life diabetes going away. There was a man, 35 years old. He had diabetes for 4 years. His diabetes was in poor control. And as time went on, he lost a lot of weight. His A1C came down to absolutely normal levels. He threw his medicines in the trash. And this was a novel thing. And by the way, this is 20 years ago. It was highly controversial. You could never tell a patient they were cured. Even though now we can. Now people have gotten used to the idea that diabetes is something that can be reversed. But at that time, it was thought to be dangerous to say that because, and understandably so, because diabetes is a rough condition. And you want patients to take it seriously and to take their medications as prescribed and to test and so forth. And you don't want people to get glib about it. That said, if we use the right dietary approach, people could do dramatically better. But it comes from a different understanding of the cause. It's not sugar and bread that causes it, something different. And once we attack that, then we have power.
I get that. So with the breaking the food addictions, it's about cravings. But the challenge I found with the diabetes was that the solution, when you first apply it, causes blood sugar spikes. And I found this so frustrating because I was already a very heavy eater. And I said, right, high carb, low fat diet. And I would eat it and my blood sugar would spike and I would back away and go back to high fat, which would then make me more insulin resistant and try again. And this went on for years. So do you have any advice for people how to navigate, especially type 2 diabetics who don't have insulin to use? How do they navigate that first hump of insulin resistance to get on a high carb diet safely?
Okay. First of all, that's a terrific question. And thank you for asking it. The important thing is to understand what causes type 2 diabetes. As I said, it doesn't come from eating sugar. It doesn't come from eating bread or potatoes. Those things will elevate blood sugar, but that's not the beginning of the story. It starts with insulin resistance. Insulin resistance just means that your muscle cells or your liver cells are resistant to insulin's effect. Normally, your muscle cells, they run on glucose. Glucose is the fuel for your muscles. Glucose molecules, sugar molecules, go into your muscle cells, and your muscles use them for energy. So you can walk and run and lift things. They go into your liver. Glucose goes to your brain. It's a good fuel. However, glucose can't get into the muscle until the insulin. Insulin is like a key. It's made in your pancreas, behind your belly button. It goes to the muscle cells. It opens them up, and the glucose comes inside. So what so that should work fine. The problem is we grew up in a culture where we're eating meat or cheese, or we might be vegan, but we're eating a lot of fatty vegan foods. And fatty foods cause fat particles to get in the muscle cells. And if it builds up, if the fat builds up inside the cell, the insulin can't work anymore. The insulin key, so to speak, arrives at the surface of the muscle cell, but it can't stimulate the cell to take glucose in. So the glucose rises in the blood and the muscle is filled with fat, and that's insulin resistance. So what do? Vegan diet means no animal fat. So if you keep all fats low, vegetable oils too, the fat starts to dissipate from the cell. So that's our job, is to get the fat out. So initially though, when you're following a vegan diet, you got a lot of fat particles in your muscle cells and in your liver cells. So anything you eat will cause your blood sugar to spike. But we're encouraging people to have carbohydrate-rich foods, grains, beans, fruits, vegetables, have them. And because what we're trying to do is to take away the fatty foods so the fat comes out of the cell. So you eat sweet potato or an apple and your blood sugar rises because the fat is still in your muscle cells. You're still insulin resistant. There are two things you can do. One is just sort of not worry about it, because as time goes on, it will get better on its own. The fat will come out of your muscle cells and you'll do better. The more rigorous we are, the quicker that happens. So where people run into trouble is, let's say they're avoiding animal products, but they're eating avocado toast, nuts, or a lot of vegetable oils, that will pack into the muscle cells too, and that will interfere with insulin sensitivity. So getting the fats out quickly really helps. The other thing that you can do is that you can choose foods that tend not to spike the blood sugar as much. Beans, fruit, they tend to not spike blood sugar too much. Whereas for many people, say bread or grain products, particularly white flour, these things, wheat flour as well, will tend to spike blood sugar a little bit. Wheat tends to spike blood sugar, rye less so. So if a person has rye toast, a little bit better choice. So you can sort of make the choices that are gentler on your blood sugar. But with time, this will settle out. And for some people, it settles out within 3-4 days. For others, it may be a couple of weeks, but it shouldn't be years. If it's years, then that makes us wonder if we need to be more vigorous about getting the fat out.
Well, I think you said some really key things there that I now have learned, but I didn't know at the time, which was I was going in, but not all the way, because I'd be scared by the high blood sugar. So I was teaching on the edge. And what you said there was if you go all in, it remedies more quickly. And eventually I got there, but that was quite a struggle. The one thing I did want to say, though, and maybe you can comment on this, are fats not equal? Because when I was eating a high-fat animal diet, my blood sugar would sometimes get as high as 18. It never got that high on, say, a junk food vegan diet, maybe 12. And my HbA1c, the difference was like 4 points. So have you got something to say about plant fats versus animal fats?
Yeah, you know, it's a fascinating thing. There at Yale University back in the 1960s, researchers started doing some terrific work on showing that insulin resistance is driven by fat intake. And an amazing study was done by Michael Roden, who trained at Yale and is now at the German Diabetes Research Center. He took volunteers, healthy volunteers who didn't have diabetes, but gave them one single fatty meal and showed that you could cause insulin resistance, not within weeks or years, but within hours in one day after one single meal. And if you use palm oil is a very saturated fat, almost like animal fat. You could cause this insulin resistance. But then he thought, well, what about canola oil, which is a more polyunsaturated and healthier fat? And it seems to be a little bit better, but it still will cause some insulin resistance. So I do think there may be some value to plant oils. And obviously, they are much better from the standpoint of cholesterol or Alzheimer's risk. Vegetable oils, dramatically better. But from the standpoint of weight and the standpoint of insulin resistance, we really want to minimize them all. And by the way, a couple of other things. Let's say a person is just starting out and their blood sugars are still a little bit high. You can also take a walk after you eat because as you're walking, the muscles start to decide, I want sugar. And so they really suck the sugar out of the blood and they put it in the muscles. So a little exercise is good. You could sometimes divide your meal in two. So you have the first half, then talk to your friends a little bit. In other words, you're eating more slowly. Then eat the second half. And that makes it a little bit simpler for your body to dispose of the glucose. For some folks, they will start their diet with something that's high roughage but low carbohydrate, like a salad or green vegetables. And they find they do better. So those are a few tips that people can do. But choosing the low glycemic index foods, that really helps. Beans, lentils, peas, that whole group is terrific. The non-starchy vegetables like broccoli, cauliflower, terrific. Berries and other fruits are really good. And they're pretty gentle on your blood sugar too.
Amazing. Well, I just want to let you know that that book was another game changer for me. Now on to your latest book. And I have had a look through it. I got hold of a copy, The Power Foods Diet. This is what struck me. I was struggling with my diabetes. And I thought, well, if I can't eat fats and I can't eat carbs, what can I eat that's neither of those? And I come up with this idea of above ground plant foods. I thought they were the best selections and I chose them. I had a look at your book and those were the five or six food groups that Harvard University recommended. I had blueberries, cauliflower, broccoli, courgettes and beans. And that's what I ate and it completely helped me with my diabetes. So this new book is now focusing on weight. Why did you write this one?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that. It's astounding. You know, we think, and so far we've been talking about things that we should not be eating. Cheese is bad for you. Meat is bad for you. Oils are bad for you. Set them all aside. And people think, what's left? Am I going to eat lettuce? And what the Power Foods Diet focuses on is foods you want to bring in, foods you want to emphasize, and foods that frankly are delicious and look great. And it comes partly from the Harvard study that you just mentioned, but from a body of other research that shows that certain foods actually cause weight loss and that not all foods are the same. Now, this is kind of obvious. If I say a potato, a baked potato without added butter and so forth, healthy food. But if I cut it into potato chips and now it's all greasy, that's not as good for weight or for health. Okay, obvious example. But there are many, many other not so obvious examples. And at the Harvard study you mentioned, this was published in 2015. They had more than 100,000 participants. They tracked what they ate and they noticed something remarkable. If you ate certain foods and if you increased your intake of certain foods, weight tended to fall. And the more you increased them, the more weight you lost. And the top of the list was the berry group, blueberries, strawberries, raspberries, blackberries. Number two was the cruciferous group, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cauliflower. Number three was green vegetables in general, like spinach and others. They're not cruciferous, but they're fine. And then after that, we had citrus, which could be orange or an orange or a grapefruit, or even juice was part of this. Melons, like a cantaloupe or watermelon. And then group number six was the legume group or the bean group, beans, peas, lentils, including, by the way, soy products. So I thought, all right, blueberries. What if we look for, make a blueberry syrup? And what you're doing is you're taking this healthy food, but you're putting it into a form that people really like. And there's also evidence that certain spices cause weight loss. Cinnamon, ginger, capsaicins, which are in hot peppers. And what if I put some cinnamon on some French toast and top it with blueberry-rich syrup? Could that be a slimming food? And the answer is absolutely. And so we made these foods in a certain way, provided the recipes, and it's beautiful, it's fun, and it works. So don't count calories, don't limit portion sizes, focus on the power foods and let the foods do the work.
That sounds great. So my journey with your education and my weight, I did this diet that I kind of made up out of necessity, which is very similar to the power foods diet. And I lost 50 pounds in like 4 months with my mum in Thailand. I then flew to London, and I hadn't been to London since before COVID, and everywhere had vegan meals, but they didn't have these vegan meals. They had vegan, everything that was not vegan, you could order vegan. And I went on this party, and I literally reversed almost half of the weight loss I had enjoyed on this power foods diet. Is it the fat that really is causing the metabolism to slow down, or is it extra calories, or how would you explain something like that from a plant-based perspective and in your new book?
Okay, what a great question, Joe. First of all, I should back up and say that if a person goes from an omnivorous diet to a vegan diet, they're making a good switch. Almost regardless of whether the vegan foods they're eating are really the most healthful or not. It's always a good idea to get the meat and the cheese off your plate. And we've seen that in our studies that people do lose weight, but they lose a lot more weight and they lose it much more easily if they focus on certain foods. So what is it that's causing it? Back in the Harvard study, if you look at group number one, the berries, that deep purple color in, say, a blueberry, or frankly, the red color in strawberries, those are anthocyanins. And anthocyanins it's actually not one color. It's a whole painting box. Blueberries, the red in strawberries, the sort of purplish color of a grape, these are variants of anthocyanins. So could it be the anthocyanins? Well, researchers in the UK brought in almost 3,000 twins, and they did what we call a DEXA scan, where the patient or participant lies on a table, you scan their whole body, and you see where their body fat is and how much do they have. And what they discovered was amazing. Within each twin pair, the one who ate the most anthocyanin-rich foods had 9% less abdominal fat compared to her genetically identical sister. So that fits with the Harvard findings, but it also means it has nothing to do with genetics. So which were the anthocyanin-rich foods? It was berries, but not just berries. If you look at a pear, they have a little red blush sometimes on them. Those are anthocyanins as well, and there are many others. So why? We don't know entirely the reasons why. Part of it could be that anthocyanins are extremely powerful antioxidants that are active probably even in your gut before you even absorb them. And it may even be that absorption is not the issue. But it also could be that the anthocyanins are just a marker. It's just a color that says this is a food that's really high in fiber, very low in fat, and one of the best ones for you. But to your question, what about the fat? Is it the fat? Well, to a great degree, fat has 9 calories in every gram, and carbohydrate has only 4. Protein has only 4. So getting away from fat is good. But that's not all there is to it. Some of these foods are bioactive. Cinnamon, for example, I mentioned. Cinnamon triggers the release of adrenaline in your body. Not hugely, but it just dials up your calorie burn. In research studies, people use about a teaspoon a day, which is more than you might want. But by doing that, people lost, maybe 3 kilograms or so inside of 16 weeks, just from the cinnamon. So my goal here is to use the foods that are healthiest and most powerful for weight loss, and then just make them bang up delicious and easy to prepare so that people will enjoy them.
So here's a question for you. There was a show on the BBC years ago called Secret Eaters, and it showed that people are often not recording mentally what they are eating, and then they think they've been following a diet and they haven't. I am very happy to look at myself, and I sometimes I think I'm following a high-carb, low-fat diet, but I'm not losing the weight. Everything else I've learned from you has come true. And I've lost a lot of weight. I'm down 70 pounds, but I can't get that extra 50 off. Do you think that it could be that I'm just still eating fat? Let me put it this way. You can eat as much as you want, provided it's high carb, low fat food. And if you add any fat in at all, that changes the algorithm. What's your thoughts on that?
When in our research studies, and we've worked with thousands of people in research studies, when somebody's having trouble or when their weight loss plateaus and they're just not losing more weight, what I'll typically ask them to do is write down absolutely everything they eat for usually about 48 hours, something like that, 2 days.
Right. Okay.
And the foods that we're looking at first are the kind of obvious ones, the things that happen to have a high fat content, because when they fill you up, they fill you up with more calories than something else. And so if there's any animal product, that would be an issue. Within the plant community, it could be nuts, seeds, nut butters like peanut butter, guacamole or avocado, or oils themselves. So there's not a lot of oil in a fruit or a vegetable or a bean or a grain. But when food manufacturers get their hands on these food, on these products, they add lots of oil. And so what we'll typically say is, on your frozen vegan pizza that you take home and put in the microwave, look for how many grams of fat there are in a serving. If it's more than 3 grams per serving, set it aside, because that's extra fat they've added at the factory that you don't need. So for many people, that's really the issue. The other thing is that we can have a set point that is, okay, I want to eat until the point of fullness, pain. What is your set point? There are people who will not eat until their stomach, who will not stop eating until their stomach actually feels physically uncomfortable. And if that's your set point, you might want to reevaluate that and just allow yourself to pick a different set point. So I do encourage people to eat until you feel finished, but quite often when a person has had a lot of extra weight, their body's trying to defend that weight. And the body works with the brain and says, don't stop eating now. Don't stop eating now. Keep going, keep going, keep going until you hurt. Now stop. And we have to kind of work with our brain to find a little bit different set point.
This makes so much sense to me because I've been told for like a decade, you can eat as much as you want. And I always think those people don't know how much I want, being a former binge eater. And I think it's probably clearer to say you can eat as much as what an average person would want and try to get some kind of balance between your satiation cues and your weight loss goals.
You know, yes, I think what you're saying is exactly right. And our normal homeostatic mechanisms should regulate this. Think about, for example, how much should you breathe? You don't have to think about it. You know, your body has very clear needs for oxygen. It really does. And it has to expel carbon dioxide. But you don't have to count it. You don't have to think about it. Your body says, you know, I've been swimming underwater for about 3 minutes. That's about it. I need to breathe now. Your body will take care of that. How much water should I drink? You don't really have to think about it. Yes, there are people who give you rules, but you can ignore them because your body has homeostatic mechanisms that say, I'm thirsty, I need some water, and it happens. With food, we get off track, partly because foods are addictive and they act more like drugs and less like foods. And when they act like a drug, they drive overeating. Secondly, unfortunately, when we have gained a lot of weight, our homeostatic mechanisms get thrown off by the body's desire to avoid losing anything. Our bodies are kind of like some people are with their bank account. Okay, even if I've got a little extra money, do I really want to give it to charity or do I want to keep it all for myself? There's a natural tendency to want to keep it, and your body is that way with body fat. And so it says, okay, I want to make sure that I keep this in case there could be a famine in the future. You know, our bodies weren't programmed recently. They were programmed a long time ago when there was such a thing as famine. And so, unfortunately, the amounts that we choose to eat go up. So those are all kind of part of the equation.
And that set point can change, that homeostasis change. Because that's what I experienced. I know my lines. They were like 320, 295, 283, 265, 255. And it would stay there for months and then for no reason drop down to another level. So that ties in. So I recommend people get this new book and all three books, because the sequence is amazing. Because I found that that moment when I was in London, and I'm going to London again soon, the Power Foods diet helps me keep on track with weight loss, and the breaking the food seductions helps stops me from straying from these programs. So a slightly different change in topic. What happened, or why was the YouTube video on Diary of a CEO removed? Lots of people are asking.
I don't know. And let me just say that I think Steve Barrett is a terrific host. And,
amazing.
We had a wonderful discussion. And I have to say, I met him in New York, and he's a delightful person. And we had a good long discussion that went on for a really long time. And when I got to the train station, I had missed my train back to Washington because the discussion was so long. But I was really quite grateful to him. So I don't know why. But my understanding is that it's being put back. And I hope it does.
So I took this YouTube video and I uploaded the audio to ChatGTP, because ChatGTP is like a hive mind. And I wanted to ask it what is controversial. And this is what it said. In his interview, Dr. Bernard claimed that men who eat the most cheese have the lowest sperm count, and criticized the carnivore diet as ludicrous. He advocates for a plant-based diet, arguing it can reverse diabetes, promoting weight loss with power foods, and criticizes food industries for profiting from westernizing indigenous diets. These controversial claims challenge established dietary habits and suggest food industry implications. What are your thoughts?
I couldn't agree more. It's impressive they pulled all those things out, but every single one of those points is entirely true and easily defensible.
Do you think it's related to the advertisers? Because, you know, the one thing that your information isn't about is selling more meat and cheese. What do you reckon?
I don't know. It's my communications people noticed that in the comments, there were some people who were reacting very strongly when I talked about the drug effects of cheese. Because there are these casomorphins in it, but that's just a biological fact. So, all dairy researchers are aware of the casomorphins. So I rather doubt that would have been a reason for, something like this to be pulled. So I'm not going to worry about it. I'm grateful to them for doing the interview, and I'm glad it's coming back.
Well, the reason why I bring this up, and it is a bit speculative, but do you think it's related to the section in your book, Drugs and Money, where you mention statins, insulin, and Ozempic, and you talk about the fact that, you know, these drugs, their role is to reduce risks that can only be reduced with medication, and not to give people like a license to put more butter on their steak. And in fact, a plant-based diet can significantly reduce the need for these medications. So from that perspective, do you think there's pressures to silence this information, or at least not disseminate it so widely, or perhaps change its tone? What are your thoughts about that?
Statin drugs are used for cholesterol lowering. They're effective. But 90% of people on a statin drug really don't need them. They wouldn't need them if they were on a diet that didn't contain cholesterol and didn't contain animal fat. And so the market for them is huge. And where this has really morphed in more recent years is with the weight loss injectables under the names Ozempic and Wegovy. In the United States, they're an enormous phenomenon, and it's starting to spread to other countries as well. Novo Nordisk, which makes Ozempic and Wegovy, these are drugs that mimic the body's natural appetite controlling mechanisms. It's a synthetic compound that you inject it, and it reduces your appetite. The Novo Nordisk spends $27 million a year in the United States as payments to physicians. You can't pay a doctor to prescribe a drug. That's not legal. But what you can pay them to do is to give a lecture to their hospital staff about how good these drugs are. And you can give them a consultancy fee. And they do that. And they also pay our politicians to try to convince them to force government programs to pay for these drugs. It costs about $15,000 a year per person for this kind of treatment. And when you, if you don't take them for the rest of your life, if you stop, all the weight you've lost comes back, or most of it. So they're very, very controversial. There are a lot of side effects, but people are told that this is the quick, easy way to lose weight. Our approach is to contain the appetite in a more natural, healthy way that saves you money and has other health benefits as opposed to risks.
Well, I wrote down a comment that occurred to me when I was thinking about this discussion, that every book you write saves lives, but it also costs someone money somewhere. Because I've spent less on junk food, right? And I think that must have the work raised into these areas. And one thing I wanted to ask you was, growing up, I feel like I was lied to a lot about food by the industry, by the advertising, and I only really found out when I got unwell. Is that still going on today? To what degree are we still being fed white lies?
Well, there's a huge amount of nonsense that occurs in food marketing, for example. We imagine that dairy products give us essential calcium and that the cows are all happily treated, that the meat industry gives us protein that you couldn't get anywhere else, that it gives you iron that is a big issue and you can't find anywhere else, despite the fact that these things are patently false. And I'm sorry to say that the other side of this is that not only does the food industry sometimes tell us things that are far from true, but when people are in ill health, the drug industry sometimes does the same. And that's a big problem here.
Right. Have you got any examples?
Back January 1st, 2023, 60 Minutes, which is one of the most popular news programs here in the United States. It's on CBS News. Everybody watches it. Everyone assumes it has great credibility. They were talking about obesity, which is a big issue. And they said the answer is a drug. The drug is semaglutide, which is marketed by Novo Nordisk under the brand name Wegovy, also under the name Ozempic, which is the same drug, just two different names. And they made a big case that if you inject yourself with this drug every week, you'll lose weight. No, that's true. But what they really soft-pedaled was the fact that there are a lot of side effects and so forth. And more importantly, they brought on medical experts. One of the medical experts said, you have to understand that obesity is genetic. If you have overweight parents, they're going to have overweight children. And this really proves the problem isn't food choices. The problem is your genes. What they did not say was, number one, overweight parents aren't just giving DNA to their children. They're giving them recipes. They're giving them food habits. And that's a big driver for obesity going across generations. The other thing that they didn't say on 60 Minutes was that every single medical expert who appeared in the program was paid by the drug manufacturer Novo Nordisk into over $100,000. They had received, and CBS itself was paid by Novo Nordisk. I'm sorry to say, this was a drug advertisement disguised as news, and we have complained. It was a 12-minute advertisement.
Wow. So, do you feel like are they doing the same as they do to the consumers? Are they doing the same to the doctors? Or is there something more sinister going on? Is it like about money, or is there a combination?
It's all money. And Novo Nordisk pays every year here in the United States $27 million to physicians. It's illegal to pay them to prescribe the drug, but it's totally legal to pay them to give a presentation to their hospital staff about how good this drug is and how safe it is and how other approaches won't work. And that's what they do. And they go further. Novo Nordisk is in Scandinavia, but they take a huge interest in American politics, and they pay the maximum amount allowed by law to American members of Congress and senators who are running for office now, because they want to make sure that they, if a bill comes up in Congress saying the U.S. government will pay for their drug, they want to be in on it. So they're smart business people. From the standpoint of your health, what is being lost is the fact that you can do these same things in a better way with food choices. And unlike Wegovy, which costs here $15,600 a year, the food choices will save you money.
Wow. So moving from drugs back to the food, right now in the world, there seems to be different fad diets, and there's always a doctor that is an advocate of them. If you look at carnivore, flexitarian, keto, paleo, and then you've got the plant-based diet. How in your world, with your experience, do you explain this gap in what one side says one thing and they're 100% certain, and the other side says the opposite and they're 100% certain?
Well, I would have to say for readers or listeners who are trying to deal with this, I feel your pain. It's very challenging to try to sort out the wheat from the chaff in this kind of situation. And part of it is a legitimate disagreement about what the science shows. In some cases, it's a disagreement about what people will do. There's a common mythology that people won't do a plant-based diet or they won't do a vegan diet. It's too strict. Now, I have to say there's a science there. We have studied that and found that people do wonder, can I do a vegan diet? But once they jump into it with a little bit of support, it is as easy as any other diet, if not easier, because you're not counting calories or limiting portions, and perhaps more importantly, the rewards are much greater. So I think these may be sometimes legitimate differences in opinion. It's also sometimes what people think will sell.
Right. What advice would you have for someone trying to navigate this? Is there some kind of North Star that they can look to, or it's a difficult question, but what advice would you give? Because what I'm saying is that I found this through ill health. Is there a way that people can find the plant-based diet without having to get sick first?
I certainly hope so, because what a price to pay. When I write a book or when we do articles, scientific articles or articles on the web or whatever, we always include the references. We try to show the evidence for it so that people can see not just what our opinion is, but what the science actually shows. And the other thing I think people can do is they can try these things. When a person does a plant-based diet, what they discover very early on is A, it's easier than you thought. B, the choices are vast. And it's kind of a fun thing to try new foods. But more importantly, the results come quickly and it feels right. So give it a try. Focus on the short term. You don't have to try it for 2 years to see what happens. And people will discover that it ends up being a really good fit.
So some of the people who haven't been around the plant-based diet for so long, maybe the last 5 years, they kind of feel that maybe it's plateaued. There was an article saying that, you know, plant-based restaurants are closing, brands are going bust. I don't think that's true. But I just wonder, with someone with your years of experience, how does it look to you right now? Is it growing? Is it stagnating?
Oh, growing enormously. Now, it's true that people start a restaurant and restaurants come and go because people are trying different parts of town, different cuisines, different ways of doing it. So they do come and go. But if you look at, first of all, look in any store. The dairy case used to have dairy in it. Now it has almond milk, soy milk, rice milk, hemp milk, everything. And it's taking over like crazy. Those sales are going so high that the dairy industry itself is now investing in non-dairy milks to diversify. You look at the meat substitutes. There are substitutes for everything. And they vary a lot. And go into any restaurant. Maybe 1 in 100 doesn't have a vegan option. A great many of them really are just putting them front and center. So things are changing. Now, don't get me wrong. Industry fights back. So you will have the meat industry and the dairy industry trying to push it away to a degree. And people have products to push. But no, we're very much on a winning track. And I have to say, that's a good thing.
It's such good news. Earlier when we spoke, I said when I went to London and I hadn't been there for a while and there was all these vegan options and I gained weight. The point I wanted to make was I never gained anything like I used to eating the same equivalent foods in those places that were animal-based. Then I was 330 pounds. So even if you don't follow a healthy life, like a diabetic diet for plant foods, you're still gaining so much from just having the same foods, but the plant-based versions.
I'm glad you mentioned that. We actually did a recent study where we looked at individuals who, we did a randomized trial. We asked people to go on a vegan diet, but they interpreted it in their own way. And the hypothesis from some people had been, if you do a vegan diet carefully and healthfully, you'll lose weight. But if you do it in sort of a junk food way, you could be worse off than before. We put that to the test. And that's not what we found. What we found is that people who want to lose weight, if they do vegan in a healthy way, they lose weight. But if they do vegan in a rather awkward way that doesn't look so healthy, they still lose weight. In other words, when people get away from meat and dairy, that's always a good change. Now, that said, I think we should be on our guard and try to do it in a healthful way. And when I say healthful, I mean no animal products. Keep the oily foods pretty low or set them aside. And choose foods in as natural a way as possible. And one challenge has come in, and that is that there are companies that are trying to appeal not to vegans, but to meat eaters with the Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat. And what they do is they put enough fat in these foods to really make them sort of juicy like a steak or juicy like a burger. And those might not be your best choices. But right next to them, in the freezer case, are better choices.
Right. One quick question relating to our earlier topic. Is fat addictive? Like, I know that it's not the same as the other more stimulative foods, but there does seem to be something that people are drawn to regarding fats. Can you explain that?
Two things. First of all, your tongue does assess the fat content of foods and gets a certain set point and wants to stay there. So if you switch to a low-fat diet, it will not be at your set point and it will taste a little light, but your set point then will adjust. And within about 2 to 3 weeks, you will prefer that set point. If you start eating a lot of fatty foods, that seems too greasy. If you stick with it, your set point will go high. So that's part of the reason I encourage people to not cheat too much, because you don't want to goof up your set point. You want to adjust it to a lower level. The other thing is that researchers have looked at foods that stimulate dopamine release and in the brain and actually are addictive. And what seems to really get us hooked is either a fat sugar mixture, candy bar, okay, chocolate bar, or a fat salt mixture, chips, potato chips, cheese, these kinds of things. That combination of either fat and sugar or fat and salt is what really gets us hooked.
Right. So what I've learned from you in terms of my own personal journey is consistency and persistence, and the diet will take care of the rest. That's what I'm taking away from this. So with that said, how do you see the future for, like, what would be the ideal plant-based world from, like, supply to consumer? How would the world look if your mission comes to total fruition?
Well, I think what we would do is realize that we have a shared mission. Nobody wants the climate to burn up at the rate it's going now. Nobody wants to see cruelty to animals. And here in the United States, Americans eat 1 million animals every hour. Nobody wants to have their life cut short by diabetes or heart disease or diet-related cancers. And nobody wants to suffer along the way by feeling that they're in a body that's not comfortable for them, by needing medical care. So if we embrace the fact that we have the same goals, the only difference is some people in the food industry are really, their income is based on unhealthy foods. Well, what I suggest we do is to help those people to transition out. Already in the U.S., we're seeing a lot of dairy farmers giving up because the demand for milk is declining rapidly. I say support those farmers and support them in the U.K. and in Europe and around the world to make a transition either to a better and more sustainable kind of agriculture, or have them go into IT, whatever it is. The idea is that there is no reason to punish these people. We learned this from tobacco. A generation ago, people were quitting smoking, and the tobacco farmers were in trouble. One option was to support them and pretend that tobacco didn't cause cancer. The other option is to support them into doing something that you can be proud of. That's the world we want. And what we will see is that we will have people who are healthier, and we'll have the next generation that, instead of having declining health compared to their parents, they'll be the healthiest generation we've ever had.
That's amazing. And what is your hope for the impact of the Power Foods Diet, your new book?
My hope is that for all those people who thought, I know a plant-based diet would be good for me, but it's got to be hard, I'm going to give up the things I love, what they're going to see is Power Foods are powerful for weight loss. It works rapidly, and it is fun. And your whole family is going to think, this is great. I want your carrot cake and your lasagna, and I want these delicious foods. The point is, we're not fooling ourselves. foods have to be configured in the right way. But there are foods that help people to lose weight, that boost their metabolism, that taste great. And when you make them the right way, then getting slim and getting healthy really is fun.
That's amazing. And when is it published? When can people buy it?
March 26th, it's coming out. And I'm hoping people will look on Amazon and maybe order it so that when the day it appears in the bookstores, they'll already have it in hand. But I also hope that if there's a bookstore near you in your neighborhood, maybe people will go there and pick it up.
Fantastic. And what is the best website to find out more about you and your work?
Oh, well, thank you. PCRM.org, that stands for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. PCRM.org.
Fantastic. It has been my absolute pleasure to talk to you today. It's been just such a dream come true, and the information has been amazing. And I'm sure our viewers will really enjoy this whole topic. So thank you very much for joining us. And I can't wait to see your book published.
Well, thank you so much, Joe. It's been a pleasure here too.
Excellent.